다바 근자비하리. 자야 거비 자나바다 바기리 바라다리 야쇼라난다나 바자자나란자나 야무나디라바나자리 고안다나 바자자나란다나 아티라 7th Canto, Chapter 9, Text 41. Evam svakarma patitam pavavaitaranyam. Nanyonya janma marana shana bita bitam. Pashyan janam svapara vayagra avaya maitram. Hanteti parachara pipri mudham adya. Nevam svakarma patitam pavavaitaranyam. Anyonya janma marana shana bita bitam. Pasyan janam svapara vigraha maya maitram. Ante di para chara pi prihi mudha danyam. Evam svakarma patitam pavavaitaranyam. Anyonya janma marana shana bita bitam. Pasyan janam svapara vigraha varya maitram. Ante ti para chara pi prihi mudam adya. Nevam svakarma patitam pavavaitaranyam. Anyonya janma marana shana bita bitam. Pasyan janam svapara vigraha varya maitram. Ante ti para chara pi prihi mudham adya. Nevam svakarma patitam pavavaitaranyam. Anyonya janma marana shana bita bitam. Pasyan janam svapara vigraha varya maitram. Ante ti para chara pi primunam adyevam. In this way, svakarma patitam, fallen because of the reactions of one's own material activities. Pava, compared to the world of nescience, birth, death, old age, and disease. Vaitaranyam, in the river known as Vaitarani, which lies in front of the doorway of Yamaraj, the superintendent of death. Anya, Anya, one after another, Janma, birth, Marana, death, Ashana, different types of eating, Bitabitam, being exceedingly afraid, Pashyan, seeing, Janam, the living entity, Sva, one's own, Pada, of others, Vigraha, in the body, Vairamaitram, considering friendship and enmity, Hanta, alas, Iti, in this way, Parachara, O you who are on the other side of the river of death, Pipri, kindly save us all from this dangerous condition. Mudham, we are all foolish, bereft of spiritual knowledge. Adya, today, because you are personally present here. Translation, my dear Lord, you are always transcendentally situated on the other side of the river of death. But because of the reactions of our own activities, we are suffering on this side. Indeed, we have fallen into this river and are repeatedly suffering the pains of birth and death and eating horrible things. Now kindly look upon us, not only upon me, but also upon all others who are suffering. And by your causeless mercy and compassion, deliver us and maintain us. Purport, Prahlad Maharaj, a pure Vaishnava, prays to the Lord not only for himself, but for all other suffering living entities. There are two classes of Vaishnavas, the Bhajanandis and Goshtyanandis. The Bhajanandis worship the Lord only for their own personal benefit, but the Goshtyanandis try to elevate all others to Krishna consciousness so that they may be saved. Fools who cannot perceive repeated birth and death and the other miseries of materialistic life cannot be sure of what will happen to them in their next birth. Indeed, these foolish, materially contaminated rascals have manufactured an irresponsible way of life that does not consider the next life. They do not know that, according to one's own activities, one receives a body selected from 8,400,000 species. These rascals have been described in Bhagavad Gita as Dushkritino Mudha. Non-devotees, those who are not Krishna conscious, must engage in sinful activities, and therefore they are mudhas, fools and rascals. They are such fools that they do not know what will happen to them in their next life. Although they see varieties of living creatures eating abominable things, pigs eating stool, crocodiles eating all kinds of flesh, and so on, they do not realize that they themselves, because of their practice of eating all kinds of nonsense in this life, will be destined to eat the most abominable things in their next life. You just imagine Mikey reading this. You know, Mikey is very much against like canola oil and refined sugars and high fructose corn syrup. And these are like the most abominable things that you can put in your body, but we eat them all the time. And, you know, we can't even really digest them. What to speak of all these other things listed here? So, anyway. A Vaishnava is always afraid of such an abominable life. And to free himself from such horrible conditions, he engages himself in the devotional service of the Lord. The Lord is compassionate to them, and therefore he appears for their benefit. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata, and a predominant rise of your religion, at that time I descend myself. Bhagavad Gita 4:7. The Lord is always ready to help the fallen souls, but because they are fools and rascals, they do not take to Krishna consciousness and abide by the instructions of Krishna. Therefore, although Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is personally the Supreme Lord Krishna, he comes as a devotee to preach the Krishna consciousness movement. Yare deka tare kaha Krishna upadesh. One must therefore become a sincere servant of Krishna. Amara agyaya guru hana tara edesh. One should become a guru and spread Krishna consciousness all over the world simply by preaching the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. Okay, again, continuing Prahlad Maharaj's prayers. And now in this verse here, he's showing the quality of compassion that he's so well known for. When you think of compassion, or when you think of compassion, you think of Prahlad. And when you think of Prahlad, you think of compassion. They're like, I don't know, it's one of the qualities. He's known for a lot of things, but this is one of them. Because he's not only thinking of himself, he's thinking of the welfare of all other living entities. So, to try to like kind of really appreciate Prahlad Maharaj's prayer to Lord Nrisingadev here, he well, first he glorifies the Lord by saying that you're on the other side of this river of death. You're always transcendentally situated, and we're here, we're suffering. So please have mercy on us, compassion on us, and please deliver us, not just me, but all of us from this suffering. So to help us kind of appreciate this, I did a little bit of research into this Vaitarani River. So I didn't really know about this river so much. And the source that I'm getting this description from may not be the most reputable source, but nevertheless it will help us. At least I think it helps. It only helps glorify the Lord a little better. So I got it from Wikipedia, so you can look it up on yourself if you want. So I'm just going to read it, and you can, and then we can appreciate where we're at and where the Lord's at and what our situation is. So, this Vaitarani River, it's mentioned in the Garuda Purana, probably many other places too, but it's the river that separates Earth, material, our existence here, with the abode of Yamaraj's abode. So there's a big river that separates the two. And it's a very, very frightening river that looks differently according to who's looking at the river. So if you're a very pious person, this river looks like liquid nectar, and it's easy to cross over, it's not a big deal. But if you are a sinful person, sinful soul, then it looks very, very frightening and horrible. So this is the description from the frightening, horrible view of this river. So the sinful soul, he sees the river as being filled with blood and pus, with heaps of bones on its banks, and mud of blood and flesh. The river is filled with hairy moss. It is filled with huge crocodiles and crowded with hundreds of flesh-eating birds. There are also throngs of dreadful insects with piercing stings, vultures, and crows with metallic beaks. There are leeches, fishes, turtles, and other flesh-eating water animals. Or this, I guess they'd be blood animals, you know, because they're inhabiting blood. So sinful souls have to cross this river after death. And so whenever there's an attempt for the soul, when he tries to cross over the river, this river actually starts to like seethe and spew out smoke, and like, you know, like you put butter into a frying pan or something and it starts, you know, kind of hissing and smoking and stuff. So when you try to cross over this blood river, that's what the river starts to do to you. And problem is, too, is that when the sinful souls are trying to cross this river, they're also very hungry and thirsty. So sometimes they actually have to eat or drink some of this river. And so that's why we're talking about eating horrible things here. That's what people have to do when they're crossing this river. So then this whole experience is very, very painful. So these souls that are crossing this river, they're writhing in pain. And there's no one there to hear them. I mean, looks like no one's hearing them. There's no rescuer for them either. So then there's always, and when you're trying to cross this river, there are these whirlpools that suck you down into it from time to time, and then they throw you back up, and then so you're kind of constantly going up and down in this river. And it's very difficult to cross. In fact, you can't even see the other shore from, it's like such a huge river, you can't even see the other shore. So this is like an impetus for us not to be sinful souls, because otherwise we're going to have to cross this river. So there is 5 ways to cross this river. And one of the ways, which is hopefully the easiest, maybe not the easiest, but a good way to do it, is to be pious. You know, if you're pious, then this river looks like nectar, and you can cross it, no problem. It's not a problem. Another one is that you can, even if you're a sinful person, if you do like pious deeds, such as like giving a cow in charity or food or doing something nice, then you still have to cross this nasty river, but you get a boat that will help you cross it. So it's much easier to cross. It's not as bad. So then another way that you can do it is your descendants can like help you. You know, like they say that, you know, you offer oblations or whatever to the forefathers or something. So then the descendants, if they do something on your behalf or something, that will help you kind of cross this river. Another way is, you know, you just have to suffer for enough time. You know, because you're destined to be in this river for so much time according to your sinful reactions. So then you have to just be there. And then after you've exhausted all of your bad karma or whatever, then it's decided, okay, now it's time, you can cross. And then the way that we recommend is what we say every morning for Guru Puja. The Yahara Prasade Bhai Ebhavatoriyajai. So that by the mercy of the spiritual master, the Guru, he helps you cross over this ocean of material existence. So that's how to do it. It's by the spiritual master trying to, with the help of the spiritual master receiving his mercy, then you can cross. You know, performing devotional service, that kind of thing. So now that's how you cross it. So when you cross it on the other side, you're going to meet Yamaraj. And Yamaraj is going to, for the pious souls, you know, they can go to heaven. So he's like, okay, you can go to heaven. But for those sinful souls, then they get their, you know, hell or wherever they're destined to go to, and Yamaraj sends them there. So, and let's say the soul never crosses this river or never even like attempts to cross the river. Then he just stands on the shore and he becomes like a ghost. You know, he doesn't go on to the next life. He's just kind of in this state of being without a body. So then another way that you can kind of understand this horrible, frightening looking river is that it's compared to the, you know, just the cycle of birth and death. And this river is, you know, with all the bones and the flesh and all this other stuff, it's actually it's symbolic of the womb, you know, like the mother's womb. So here we are, we're getting born again and again, and we have to go through this river of being born, going through another womb, and then having to go through this whole experience. And then, of course, if you live piously, then you can just kind of, you don't have to take another birth again, and you don't have to go through this river of birth. Okay, so that's our situation that Prahlad Maharaj is talking about when he mentions this river Vaitarani River. And he's showing his compassion, and he's calling upon the compassion of the Lord to help us out here in our predicament. So I was also doing a little research into compassion, and I came across some different understandings of compassion, and particularly I was looking at this Tibetan Buddhism way of understanding compassion, and it's, a lot of it's similar to our understanding, except for the very final like understanding of what is compassion. So then on the kind of like the initial beginning stages of compassion, there's this general compassion that is common to just about every religion that there is. And this kind of compassion is where you have this wish to relieve others of their suffering. The others are suffering, you can empathize with that, you feel that in a sense, and you want to help relieve others of their suffering. So it's a very basic understanding of compassion. And and a lot of this kind of compassion is considered to be like essential. It's you know just like breathing and having water and food and everything. So people need to have this kind of compassion to be able to live. Or there has to be this kind of compassion. It's when seeing the sufferings, when knowing and seeing the sufferings of others, when that becomes intolerable to you, you know, here we are, we're kind of in this comfortable situation, we have all the comforts and pleasures, and we don't have to worry about so many things. But when you're in that situation where you're comfortable, and at the same time you know that others are suffering, going through so many horrible things, you know, disease like anything, people are starving, and so many issues are going on in the world, when that becomes intolerable for you, then compassion starts. You know, like that's the beginning of compassion. And then I was just thinking of an example, which I don't know, I was just thinking of Mother Teresa when I was thinking about her compassion. So she, one time there's this interviewer who from America who was interviewing Mother Teresa, and he asked her like, oh, is there anything I can do for you, because you know you're such an exalted person, is there anything I can do for you? And Mother Teresa was just like, no, it's okay, there's nothing you can really do for me. And then so then the interview went on, and then this interviewer asked again, you know, is there anything that I can do for you? And then again she didn't really say anything. And then finally the interview ended, and then this guy asked again for the third time, is there anything that I can do for you? And then so she said, well, you know, for me there's not really anything you can do, but if you really want to do something for me, then, you know, tomorrow morning you can wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you can go out and find somebody who thinks that they're alone in this world and try to convince them that they're not alone. So that's, I thought that was a nice example of some kind of compassion that you understand, you feel for other people's suffering, and then because of that feeling that you have naturally, it arises that you have this desire to try to want to mitigate that suffering. So, and then also they've done some research on this kind of compassion. Like, I don't know all the details of the research, but they've studied it in different ways. And they found that when you do acts of compassion, it actually increases the neural connections in the brain, and you can actually make more connections and see things more clearly in an interconnected way. And then also it improves your immune system somehow. That if you're always trying to help others and be compassionate, then your own immune system improves. But if you're always like constantly thinking about how you feel and yourself and your problems, your immune system goes down. So I remember Tony He was the massage guy, big guy who was here. He was washing pots for some time. Anyway, he's this guy who's really big into healing. And so sometimes people come and see him, and then they tell him, oh, I've got this problem, I've got that problem. And Tony. So he's got, there's people come to him with all kinds of problems. And then the first thing he asks them when they come to him is, you know, so what are you doing for others? And then, you know, it kind of like makes them snap out of it a little bit. Like, what do you mean? And then he explains that, you know, if you kind of get out of yourself and then you try to focus on helping others and being compassionate to others, then it actually makes you feel better. It's kind of a mystic thing, but that's how it is. Okay, so that's one level of compassion that's kind of common everywhere. Everyone kind of agrees with that. So then the Buddhists, they kind of take this a little, another step forward, forward or another step, I don't know what way, what direction it is, but they have another understanding of compassion. And basically it includes everything that was said here about compassion, but it adds another element. And that element is that it's the capacity to clearly see into the nature of suffering. And that not only do you understand what is suffering, but you understand that I'm not separate from that suffering. And I actually give this example, too, of Yudhishthir. And when he was being questioned by his father, Dharmaraj, about, you know, what is the most wonderful thing in this world? And Yudhishthir Maharaj answers, well, the fact that, you know, so many people around us are dying all the time, but yet we don't think it's going to happen to us. So they actually like that example, whereas when you realize that you're not different than the suffering that's going on everywhere, that you're actually kind of a part of that in a way, and that compassion means to like feel other people's suffering. So then there's this idea that, you know, how horrible is that? You know, here I am. I'm suffering like anything. I'm miserable. I've got, you know, this headache and that, this ache, and that I don't have enough money. I don't, whatever, all the problems that I have. And now it's being recommended that I feel compassionate to others. And compassion means that I also feel what they feel. And if they're also feeling all of these miserable suffering conditions, then how horrible is it to be compassionate? You know, imagine if you had to feel the 100 people's sufferings as your own. I mean, it's misery. I mean, that's like compounds your misery 100 times or something. But the interesting thing about compassion, which is a little paradoxical, is that when you feel the misery and sufferings of others, many people think that it drains you. Like, oh, I'm giving myself. I'm constantly giving and trying to help others, and I'm not taking care of myself or something. But what happens is when you give, you think about others, you get out of yourself, it actually enlivens you. So that's like the paradox of this kind of compassion, in which they recognize in Buddhism, and which we also kind of can relate with. I mean, that just makes sense. So that's another level. And then there's three aspects to this kind of compassion, which they kind of expand upon. So one is that compassion, a key aspect of compassion is that it is more fun. Fun, you know, they bring up this concept of fun into the whole idea of compassion, which is kind of mind blowing. And so then, you know, like particularly when you see like the Dalai, many people think Buddhism is boring because you just sit and meditate and that's all you do. But and then when they have that conception of Buddhism, when they see like someone like the Dalai Lama, who is super jolly and happy and smiling all the time, even though he has every right to, you know, be in this very sorrowful mood, you know, like his people are practically going through a genocide, or they have been for so long, and they're being oppressed, and you know, they're like really doing terrible things. I won't go into all the details that's going on with the Tibetan people, but and this Dalai Lama was the leader of these people there, he and who's developed this kind of compassion. He's feeling all of the suffering that's going on with his people, all of the things that they do in the prisons, all of the, you know, the abuse and all, you know, taking over their lands and whatever all of it is. So he's feeling that, but at the same time he's laughing and he's having fun in a sense. And the idea is that it's because it's, you know, first of all, you being miserable isn't going to help the situation. Like, if you're feeling compassion for somebody else's misery, you being miserable is not going to help in any way. It's just going to make it worse. So then he kind of realizes this, and then all you can do is laugh. You know, that's the kind of the idea. And then he also kind of helps, he gives another, the Dalai Lama also helps us frame it this way. He says that when compassion, when the idea of compassion, like, is born in your mind, then you realize that all of your pains and pleasures and things going on in your body, that they're actually too small of a theater for your intelligence. So, you know, the intelligence is viewing all of the feelings and stuff that's going on in the body as like a theater, like a play that you're watching. And if you have a very small intelligence, then you're happy and satisfied and whatever with all the feelings and stuff going on in your body. But when compassion arises, your intelligence either becomes bigger or something, and that you realize that in order for me to feel satisfied and happier, I have to get out of my body, and I have to experience or relate with and feel not only my suffering but the sufferings of others. And so he almost sees it like a theater, like a play that's going on, and that my own issues aren't that exciting, but, you know, with others, and it kind of expands my experience, mode of compassion. Okay, so that's, you know, perhaps a little better. You know, it gets a little more subtle and maybe more refined, that kind of compassion. So then the next, perhaps a little more compassionate than that, is when you, it includes all these other levels, but then there's this extra addition of compassion where you realize the impermanence in things. You realize that everything changes and it's impermanent, and that the reason for suffering is that people think that they cling to this belief that there is permanence in this material world or whatever. So because of that, so that's like an extra level of compassion. If you understand what is causing all this suffering, it's just people thinking that this is a permanent situation or something like that, and because they get attached to that, it changes and suffer. So when you have that understanding, that's another deeper level, perhaps, of compassion. So then the Buddhists, they go into this whole other, they say this is the highest level of compassion one can exhibit. And this is where the Hare Krishnas differ from Buddhism. The Buddhism, they say that the highest level of compassion is when you realize that, this is a little difficult to explain, I don't fully get it myself, but you have this complete knowledge that those beings, that those who are suffering, that all of that is suffering, it lacks any true existence. It doesn't actually exist. All the suffering that goes on, the souls who experience suffering, everything, the actual suffering, the objects of suffering, everything about it, it just doesn't exist. And so basically this is compassion without an object. There is no object of compassion here. I'm just this, it's a way of being where you're somehow compassionate and there's no object to that compassion. And they also describe it as where when you recognize the emptiness of all things, when you recognize the emptiness of all things, that's when you can exhibit this kind of compassion. So they say, seeing emptiness is like their sutra. Seeing emptiness, have compassion. So it doesn't quite register for most of us as being the highest level of compassion. But that's what the Buddhist idea of compassion is. So the Hare Krishna idea is a little different. I mean, up until that last thing, it wasn't, you know, it kind of jived. You know, we kind of can agree with it. But the very last, like, element of compassion there, it doesn't really fit in with our Siddhanta so well. So the Hare Krishna method of compassion is mentioned here in this verse and in the purport about, well, first the Lord's compassion. You know, the Lord exhibits compassion, one, by coming whenever there's a rise in irreligion, and, you know, whenever there's a need to implement religious principles and religious life, the Lord comes and then exhibits his compassion that way. He also comes as Lord Chaitanya, and he teaches us by his perfect personal example how to become a devotee and perfect our lives and become happy that way. So those are two like ways in which he exhibits compassion. Another way he exhibits it is through his devotees. And here there are two kinds of devotees, the Bhajananandis and Goshtianandis. And the Goshtianandis particularly, they're in this mood of actually intentionally going out and preaching, trying to connect souls with Krishna. So that's the Hare Krishna idea of compassion. That's the ultimate thing, is trying to connect souls to Krishna, and that's the highest compassion. Anyway, this example has probably come up many times, but it's so awesome that it can be repeated so many times and it's still nice to hear, is that Prahlad Maharaj, he comes again as Vasudev Datta. You know, so Vasudev Datta, he's known for going to Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya says, you know, Vasudev Datta is looking different or something, and Lord Chaitanya says, what's going on? What can I do for you? And then Vasudev Datta said, there's this long-standing desire that I've had in my heart for a long time. I was wondering if you can fulfill it. And Lord Chaitanya's like, yeah, what is it? And Vasudev Datta said, well, you know, I'm seeing that so many people are suffering here in the material world, and it's unbearable for me. I can't tolerate it. So can you please relieve them of all of their suffering, and I'll take all of the suffering, all of their karma, all of the everything, and I'll put it on my head, and I'll experience it. I'll experience suffering eternally so that others can be relieved from their suffering, so that they can, go back to Godhead, perfect their lives, that kind of thing. So, you know, when Lord Chaitanya heard this, he just started sobbing, and, you know, he got these, like, really ecstatic feelings of just, like, wow, how amazing is Vasudev Datta? And he said, you know, I am now your property. Whatever you want to do with me, you want to sell me, whatever you say, I am now yours. So he became, Lord Chaitanya became his property because of his really deep compassion. And he said, you're none other than Prahlad Maharaj. And then here Prahlad Maharaj is exhibiting the same kind of compassion. Anyway, I said this before, but Radhanath Maharaj, when he was glorifying Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, and, you know, this really amazing Sunday feast lecture, which everybody should hear. It's like the most heart-wrenching, like, it's like really, really, really nice lecture. And in this lecture, he was just glorifying Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj for like hours. And in this lecture, he was saying how Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, he really was inspired by Vasudev Datta. Like, that was his main role model in his life. So for one Vyasa Puja, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, he wrote to Prabhupada saying that, you know, I travel around so much. I'm seeing the devotees, how they're suffering with their bad habits, their anartas, they're depressed, or they're not experiencing Krishna consciousness the way you're giving it to them. Anyway, all these devotees are having so many problems and they're suffering. And he was just feeling this overwhelming compassion for all of the devotees. And so he told Prabhupada in his Vyasa Puja offering that, I want to take the spirit of Vasudev Datta, and I want to take the suffering, their karma, whatever it is that's blocking them from really taking the Krishna conscious seriously, I want to take that on my head, and so that they can progress, you know, go on in their Krishna consciousness with less obstruction, with no obstructions. So then, right after he did that, or soon after he made that proclamation, he actually ended up getting this melanoma cancer, or some really serious cancer that cannot be cured. And it was very tenacious and really ripped, you know, really did a number on his body. So, he is getting what he asked for, it seemed. And so when he was like, just before he left his body, he was like on his deathbed practically, and Radhanath Maharaj was there, and Radhanath Maharaj told Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj that, you know, today is the disappearance day of Mukunda Datta. And then Mukunda Datta is the son of Vasudev Datta. And then when Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj heard the name Vasudev Datta, he just started like, you know, going in this like ecstasy, hearing just the name Vasudev Datta, that he started like kind of swaying and crying. And then he just started repeating, Vasudev Datta, Vasudev Datta. And then he was like, you reminded me of Vasudev Datta. Thank you so much. And then he just started going in this like really intense ecstasy, just thinking about Vasudev Datta. And he's just like, because you've reminded me of Vasudev Datta, I'm so grateful. And he just got this like, he just kept repeating it, Vasudev Datta, Vasudev Datta. And then he got really excited, and he asked all the devotees, okay, let's start kirtan now. And then he was starting, and then they were doing this like really long kirtan, and Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj really thought that he was going to leave his body at that point, because it was an auspicious day, it was connected with Vasudev Datta, and he was thinking that, okay, this kirtan, I'm going to leave my body in this kirtan, this is it. And he got everybody in this fired up kirtan, and then after so many hours, nothing, he didn't leave his body. So then anyway, he stopped the kirtan, he said, okay, today is an auspicious day because it's connected with Vasudev Datta, so you can all go back to your services now. Anyway, so that was like the story. But it was really, really sweet. And whenever I see this kind of compassion, I think of that story. I think of Vasudev Datta, and I think of Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. So anyway, I thought I'd just share that here. Okay. Well, then here's anything anybody would like to add.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you for your class. Thank you for sharing all the stories. One point when I was meditating on this verse, one verse that came across the Chaitanya Charitamrita that I remember when I read this verse, I want to reference this so other devotees could look at it to verify. It's in Ancha Lila, chapter 3, verse 31, 32, and you can read Prabhupada's reports to those. It's the pastimes of Haridasa Kaur. Basically, that pastime says that Lord Chaitanya was questioning Haridasa Thakura, how can the people of Kali Yuga be relieved of their suffering? As if, of course, as if the Lord doesn't know. But he was asking Haridasa Thakura. And Haridasa Thakura explains to the Lord, you know, don't be in anxiety, don't be unhappy. And then in one purport, Prabhupada says, basically, that we could be merciful to the Lord. And he describes how, that seems like a paradox, how we could be merciful to the Lord. But basically, Prabhupada says, by being Goshta Nandis, by preaching this Krishna consciousness. I have a few comments in that regard. Maybe you could elaborate on it. One thing from my personal experience which may discourage some people from preaching is that they may not feel empowered to preach. There's one verse in the Ancha Lila that says, Kali Kaleta Dharma Krishna Nama Sankirtan Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Tata Pravartana. Unless one is empowered by Krishna, one cannot preach Sankirtan. So, one thing that I know that discouraged a lot of devotees is that sometimes over the years I felt that, you know, many devotees make you feel inadequate. Oh, you don't know this, you don't know that verse, or you don't know this verse, etc. So one pastime that you could elaborate on this if you like. One pastime that I appreciated was the pastime Hanuman and the spider. Hanuman could lift boulders, and the spider tried his best. He lifted dust. But that doesn't mean necessarily that Hanuman is more empowered and the spider isn't less empowered, because it's all coming from the Lord. So can you elaborate on that point, that how one shouldn't become discouraged just because one doesn't know a lot of Sanskrit verses? Or the real empowerment is to be determined, regardless of what devotees say. Devotees may say, oh, you don't know a lot of verses, or you, et cetera. We shouldn't let anyone discourage us. So can you elaborate on that point, how we should be determined, especially in regards to this mother, just sold a pastime. She was determined. Krishna gave her a mercy, and so was the spider. So,
well, I mean, those things, like if somebody talks about somebody tells you that you're inadequate, or if it makes you feel that way because you can't memorize verses or something, like makes you feel inadequate in some way or another. I mean, we could just relate it back to this whole idea of compassion. You just have to get out of yourself. So if somebody makes you feel inadequate and you have this feeling of, I don't know, whatever, you beat yourself down or you have whatever these feelings that go on inside of yourself, then you can, a nice way to get out of that is by exhibiting compassion. You get out of yourself and you start, and you understand that there's suffering going on and you try to help others in their suffering. And the best way that we know how to do that is by helping, giving people, trying to help connect people to Krishna. So if you can kind of get out of yourself, then these things won't impact you so much. If somebody tells you that you're inadequate or somebody judges you or whatever, then it's not going to affect you because you're not even really so in yourself, in a sense. So they can say whatever they want. I'm out here trying to help, and whatever you say to me, it's not really doing much. Yeah, I think you said something earlier that I was going
to say. Well, that reminds me, that was a nice point, because that reminds me of one point you made. You said, to the degree, whatever one's consciousness is, he'll see the river in a particular way, that Vait Sarani, or whatever mm-hmm. it's called. If you're pious, you'll see a good river. And that's kind of how I could relate this to the Hanuman story, or how we relate to devotees. Some devotees may see another devotee as, proud, and some other devotees may see the same devotee as humble, according to our consciousness. And with the regards to the pastime Hanuman that I really appreciate about, I'm not sure if this is mentioned, but essentially it's mentioned in all our teachings that it's not like the spider viewed Hanuman as proud. He didn't take away his service to gossip about Hanuman and take away his service. So basically, my understanding is that we should see the Lord in every situation. And the Gita, Krishna says, Ma mana bhava ma bhato, always think of me in every situation. So basically, my understanding is that Hanuman is just a test. The Lord is aspiring, Hanuman with pride to test the spider's determination. So if we view it, can you elaborate on that point? If we view it that way, then we won't be so absorbed in, wasting our time trying to get revenge on someone being so-called proud, which is actually a test from the Lord. So.
I don't know the spider's psychology in that incident. I don't know if it was
I'm more talking about general principles, but
I would imagine, I don't know if the spider, but if we were in that kind of a situation where another devotee was, saying, get out of the way, let me do this service, you're not doing it properly, then we could just, we can be very humble about it. There's different responses we can have according to our, it's not so easy, and, depending on the circumstances, all the details, it might be different. Hanuman, he was Hanuman, so the spider was probably just, Hanuman, all right, go Hanuman. But if we just have one of our friends who we think are on the same level as a peer do something like that, that to us might be harder to take. If a senior devotee comes and takes over a service and does it better, we're like, we want that. We want to do what's most pleasing to Krishna. So if others can serve Krishna better than we can, then great. We want to help and assist them however we can. That's kind of could be our mood. It's a little harder to do that with peers sometimes because either we think that we can do it as well as they can or better, and they're proud or whatever. So anyway, that's our own. We have to overcome that and try not to think that way. So, okay. Anything else? Mitch? How's your foot?
It's doing better.
It's doing better?
Yeah.
Good.
Hare Krishna. I was wondering if you could elaborate more on the purpose of death and the function that it serves in this material world and how a devotee views death.
Well, death is a really good thing in this world because it helps us realize that we don't really belong here. Because by nature, we're eternal and we don't die. We're eternal, Satchitananda, eternally conscious and blissful and existent, eternally exist. So this idea of death is a very foreign concept to the soul. So the fact that we have to experience death as souls, it's supposed to wake us up and realize that, maybe I'm not supposed to be here. And it provides a really good impetus to get out and go to be with Krishna in the spiritual world eternally. So it's just like a correctional tool, you know, like in, you know, in prison they have so many, it's supposed to be a correctional facility to correct behaviors and whatever, so they might have all these programs that go on in the jail to help one become, you know, a better citizen and, you know, whatever. They have so many issue programs, they engage them in different kinds of services and they help them in different ways. So death is like one of the things that we have to experience in the material world, which is meant to help correct our consciousness. And we get a lot of realizations from having to go through death and think about death and prepare for death. And it's like an exam. So yeah, it serves that function, I think. I think that's as far as I understand. Okay, anything else? All right, well, I'm here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.